Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And we are continuing our journey through the digestive system. In our last episode, we dealt with smelling food, tasting food, chewing food, getting food all wet and gross in your mouth so it may continue the journey. And so in this episode, we are, in fact, continuing the journey. As you know, some of our series, we tell you, oh, make sure you go back and listen to part one and listen to part two. This one, you can probably mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
I think everyone knows that, yes, food needs to go through your mouth before it goes into your esophagus and stomach.
Yeah, but what's so cool about that episode is that we learned about how your tongue is bathed in saliva, and the saliva really brings all those flavors to you, and that so much of our ability to smell something or detect a flavor has to do with the tongue, and that those are receptors in the back of our throat that are actually detecting that smell. So actually, I just gave it away, but there's a lot of really cool stuff in that episode. So, yeah, you've gone through that episode, hopefully, with us, and you were about to plunge down the gullet.
Yes.
And spelunk inside the stomach.
Yeah, and like last time, we were inspired to do this one a little bit by Mary Roach's new book, Gulp, which I highly recommend everyone pick that up if you're at all into science, if you're at all into food and digestion, into laughing or learning. It's a great book. We're really enjoying it. And also check out our interview with Mary Roach, which we'll have published by this time.
Yeah, it is great. As usual, she has so many interesting things to say. So, yeah, let's talk about this journey into the stomach. And let's think about
previously on Nose to Tail.
Yes, previously.
We smelled a haggis. We tasted a haggis. We put a haggis in our mouth.
Uh-huh.
The haggis is then chewed as much as you can chew haggis. Chewed up, we get saliva on there, we get various enzymes, and we have formed a what? What is this cargo?
Bolus.
The bolus.
And just as a reminder, haggis is essentially like a turducken of organ meat encased in sheep stomach.
Yes.
Right. So all of that gets chewed up in our mouth, and as you say, it becomes the bolus haggis.
It's like a gross, mucousy, foody football that's about to be passed to the rest of the digestive system.
That's right. What happens is that you get the swallow reflex, and it's activated, and the larynx elevates and closes to avoid portions of the food, bolus haggis, entering the trachea.
Yeah, because that's bad. That's choking. That's not being able to breathe.
You get big ball of organs trying to go down your windpipe.
Yeah.
Bad news.
Yeah, and as Mary Roach points out, two of the bad ones to actually get down there, of course, are the grape and the hot dog. Slice of hot dog on the grape. Both just the right size to block your windpipe.
Right,
if it goes down the
perfect circumference to mimic the circumference of your windpipe. So, yes, that is why, actually, they say with kids, toddlers, to, always cut up a hot dog or grapes. That's the very reason.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, so the bolus is entering this esophagus. And the esophagus, I think, is wonderful because it really is the beginning of this long tube of your digestive system. Because if you think about this, it really is a tube from your mouth to your anus.
Mm-hmm.
It's just in different types of sculptures along the way.
Yeah, it's like one long winding hallway through a house. The decorations change, the carpeting changes, but ultimately it's the same pathway.
Right, and for this pathway, it's a pretty straight shoot. We're talking about 8 inches here, and it does have two parts. There's the upper esophageal sphincter,
mm-hmm.
that's the UES, and that is under our conscious control, right? So that is helping us to eat, to breathe, to belch, and to even vomit when we need to. And it is essentially keeping food from going down the wrong pipe, right? The upper part of our esophagus. Now, the lower part is involuntary, and its muscles are kind of like the doorman to the stomach, making sure that acid and food don't travel backwards into the esophagus.
Yes, that's bad. Though that does happen, of course. And sometimes it's important that it happens in the case of regurgitation.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the cool thing about the esophagus is it's essentially made up of these muscles that are easing the food downward, especially in the process of peristalsis.
Yes, peristalsis. It's kind of I can't help but think of like a snake eating something.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you accidentally put your hoodie in the washer and dryer without tying up the cords, and the cord comes out, and then you have to carefully, like, work it through the hood again.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of, like, gradual process, right?
Yeah, it's smooth muscle movement. And it is sort of like you think about a worm or a snake, mm-hmm. sort of moving along. And now peristalsis begins in the esophagus and it goes all the way to the anus, right? So this is a movement that really does kind of usher your food from one station to another. And when we talk about the esophagus, the movement is initiated by circular smooth muscles contracting behind the chewed food. And then it's followed by a contraction of longitudinal smooth muscles, which pushes the digested food forward or down. So you could do a cartwheel and you could be digesting and it would still move your food in the correct direction because it is those muscles that are really making sure that food is going down, not necessarily gravity.
Right. Now, we're still in the upper esophagus at this point, right? And now this is the area where everything's still under conscious control for the most part. We're still more or less in charge of the food movement. But when we get into the lower esophagus, that's where it becomes more of a subconscious movement. It's no longer really our affair what's going on with the food. It's been passed on to a different division.
That's right. I mean, it's all in preparation for shooting it into the stomach, right?
Right.
Into the big vat of acid. And I did want to interject something here, that when that bolus lands in that big vat of acid, we get these noises gurgling from our stomach.
Yes.
And there's an actual name for these noises.
This was new to me. This was a surprise.
Yeah. This is a bit of onomatopoeia going on. Mm-hmm. The word is borborygmi.
Because it sounds exactly like what it is.
Yeah, if you slow it down.
What it sounds like. Or both, really.
Yeah, if you slow it down, it's a borborygmi. Like, doesn't that sound like my stomach just...
It does sound like stomach.
That's had a bit
generally
to say.
That kind of gurgly noise that generally makes itself heard during the quiet parts of movies or on dates or in waiting rooms, anywhere where it's nice and quiet and your digestive system is reminding you that even though you were taking it easy, it's work time downstairs.
That is exactly. It's kind of like the digestive system's work song,
yeah.
Like whistle your while you work song. It's like, hey, this is going on, blubber ring me. Or something like that.
Sometimes the cat sits on my shoulder.
Yeah.
And, the other day she was doing it, and I could hear the sound of her digestion. It was just like...
Yeah, I've heard my cats as well.
Yeah.
And you know,
like
he's
the ocean.
He's a giant cat, by the way, and he eats a lot. he's a 26-pound cat, so you can really hear his digestion. And he snores, too. And sneezes. The interesting thing about the borborygmi is that it's the gas in the air that's trapped in what we are now calling chyme, formerly the bolus.
Okay. Now it's like now that the slurry ball has become just this slurry highway of goo called the chyme.
Yeah, the chyme is just we've changed names here because we've put more additives in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have added some gastric juices to the mix. And so it's that gas and air that's trapped in the chyme that is making those noises. And if your stomach or your small intestine is relatively empty, it's going to make louder noises. So Jessica Toothman has a great article on our website about this, and she likened it to when you put shoes in a dryer. And you can hear, because there's just one thing, right? Just the shoes and a dryer, and it's just boom, boom around in the dryer. But if you put a bunch of towels in there, then it would muffle the sound.
Oh, okay.
So that is why sometimes your borborygmi is louder than other times.
It all comes back around to washing machines.
It really does, right? We talked about this last time about how the saliva is essentially a detergent, the enzymes in it.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We have delivered you to the stomach, and there's a lot more to come as we discuss what actually goes on in the stomach. This is kind of the main stage, really. So, of course, we're going to talk some more about the stomach activity. But first, a quick break, and then we're back.
All right, we're back, and we are in the belly of the beast.
We are in the belly. And again, anytime I think about like stomach activity, I always go back to the movie Inner Space, the climactic battle in Martin Short's stomach between the bad guy inside of a little robot submarine dude and then the good guy who was it? Dennis Quaid. And they're, like, duking it out. And then the bad guy gets out of his... his submarine gets partially destroyed, so he's, like, trying to drill into Dennis Quaid's submarine.
Uh-huh.
And then all the stomach acid comes up and just dissolves him down to a skeleton there on the front of the submarine.
You know, you have just described, really, this sieve theory
Yeah.
That we'll get to in a moment. And it's about beneficial bacteria. And
get rid of the bad guys and allow the good guys like Dennis Quaid to potentially continue the journey through the body.
Man, that totally should have been in this paper that was published.
Yes.
About sieve theory. But yeah, let's talk about how this plop of chyme enters into the stomach chamber. And there is another set of digestive glands in the stomach lining. The first one that we met in the mouth, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got your saliva there. This next set of digestive glands is producing stomach acid and enzymes that further break this stuff down.
Yeah, and this is more hardcore for sure. Now, I don't know if it's dissolving bodies to skeleton in a matter of seconds powerful, because there's a part in Mary Roach's book Gulp where she actually has some stomach acid put on her skin because she wants to feel what it might be like. And it's not an immediate burning sensation. It doesn't like eat through her arm like xenomorph blood or anything. It's not at that potent. Now it's potent. It's acid, but there's nothing just crazy about it. It's not like sulfuric acid or something.
Yeah, but it should be noted that the major components of gastric juices are mucus,
yes,
pepsin, and hydrochloric acid.
Yes.
And on the pH scale, humans actually have an acid level of 2. Now, the lower the level, then the higher the actual acid of the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty acidic.
It's pretty acidic, but again, not like crazy sci-fi movie acidic necessarily.
Yes, that's right. But it does the job, and
yes.
So it's especially when you come to something like the sieve theory, and the idea is that the stomach isn't just there as a holding pattern for your food and to make it a little bit mushier and to mm-hmm. get it even more further broken down. Although it does that. The theory is that the stomach is also there to weed out the good microbes versus the bad microbes. And Scientific American blogger Rob Dunn actually found an interesting study from 1948 by Dr. Orla Jensen. She was a retired professor from the Royal Danish Technical College. And in the study, Orla Jensen posits that the stomach isn't just that blender, but it really is doing this job of weeding out the bacteria.
Because, again, as we've discussed in past podcasts, the body is loaded with microbes. We are just a big hotel full of things. And the microbes living in my body aren't exactly the same. It's not exactly the same population as you have, as the next person has. But that being said, there's an order here. And not everyone that lives on the 10th and 11th floor are allowed to go up to the penthouse or down to the penthouse in this environment.
It's true. And then you have to consider something like our friend the vulture, which we've talked about before, and its pH level.
Yes.
Because we've talked about pathogens like anthrax.
Right.
Actually being present in the feces of this bird, and this idea that stomach acid could actually render it harmless.
Yeah, because they're eating some pretty nasty stuff, and again, it's all right. It comes into the mouth, fine. It comes in the esophagus, fine. But in the stomach, this is where it ends. That's where it has to be nullified to continue.
Now, Orla Jensen knew that the human stomach, the pH levels in it, actually increases with age, meaning it becomes less acidic. And she also noted that this effect is really acute in people who are over 70 years of age. So she predicted that the stomach's effectiveness as a killer of bad microbes might be compromised as we get older. And this is one of the reasons that diseases take us over at older ages, right? So she tested this by culturing bacteria that her and her team had collected from fecal samples of 90 humans. One-third of whom were between the ages of 30 and 40, and two-thirds who were over the age of 70. They then compare the microbes found in the samples from these different age groups. So let me just kind of go through what they found here, because it really is interesting. 9% of the individuals over 70 had more than 1 million cells of bad news Clostridium bacteria per gram of feces. We've talked about that before. That is a real... can be a permanent game changer for people in terms of their quality of life and sometimes the length of their life. None of the 30 to 40 year olds had this, okay? What was more, a third of the individuals over 70 had more than 1 billion cells per gram of feces of the oral bacteria Streptococcus salivarius. And again, none of the 30 to 40 year olds did. So Dunn says, well, were these pathogenic and oral bacteria doing well enough to actually compromise the success of good bacteria in the gut? Yes, This is true. It did. While all the 30 to 40-year-olds had at least 1 million cells of the good gut bacteria, less than half of the individuals over 70 did. So what this is painting, this story, is that our health is directly related to the microbes in our gut, and our stomach is maintaining this community of bacteria. The older you get, the less able you are to sort it, to sieve it. And that's where this idea of microbe sieve theory comes into play.
See, that's interesting, because essentially the older stomach is less scrutinizing when it comes to who should be let into the trust zone of the intestines. And it kind of parallels these studies you see about how older individuals are more likely to be taken by con men, because there's a certain amount of trust that's greater in so many of these older individuals.
You know, what's really interesting about that analogy is that the guts of those people who were 70-year-olds and had dementia mm-hmm. were actually in worse shape than any of the participants.
Huh.
So it's a little bit like you wonder if the dementia is at play here in terms of communicating with the body to try to weed out those microbes.
Oh, that's a fascinating idea. I had never really thought about that.
Yeah.
Like dementia not only of the conscious mind, but of subconscious processes. Huh.
Yeah. So it makes me think again of the bearded one, Aubrey
yes.
de Grey, and this ability to get to the disease before it happens. So do we alter our pH levels in our stomachs as we get older? Can we do that?
Yeah, I say go for it.
It's a good bit of information, I think, to consider.
Yeah, because, again, it's his whole thing is let's figure out. Like, we can't defeat death itself, his self, herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's too intimidating. But if you break it down into a whole list of individual achievable goals, mm-hmm. then maybe you can do something.
Right. Like, okay, here's the stomach. Let's try to battle it this way.
Yeah. Because the idea here is that the human body is like a car and it has all these parts. Certain parts give out. And then you reach the point where a whole bunch of parts are giving out and then the thing just falls apart on the highway. But if we can maintain these various parts, then maybe the car will hold up longer than it has been.
Indeed. And I think that this study that Rob Dunn brought up in the Scientific American article is just really interesting because it's kind of hit its time. In 1948, it was sort of sitting there and it's an interesting bit of information. But mm-hmm. now that we have the understanding that we have of microbes, it's sort of poised to change the landscape of how we deal with microbes, good and bad.
Now, back to the car analogy for a second. I do not know much about cars. So when I open the hood of a car, I look in there, and I tend to trust that everything in there is important and that I shouldn't just go in and rip something out and expect the car to work fine.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, I know a little more, I know a bit more about the human body than about the inside of the car, and I still generally ascribe to the notion that if it's in there, it probably needs to be. And if it doesn't need to be in there any longer, then my body may let me know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But as we're about to discuss, sometimes things can disappear from the body, and the body will continue to work just fine. And I mean, that's a bit of an overstatement of the obvious. Obviously, people in many cases have lost an organ or two.
Mm-hmm.
They've had it replaced with an artificial, with a transplant, etc. But I really had not thought long and hard about the fact that you can remove the stomach from a human being, fix them back up, and the body can more or less adapt just fine.
Right, which is, I think, a surprise because the gut seems so central to the food processing part, right? But what we have found is that there's something called a gastrectomy, and this is a medical procedure that involves surgically removing all or part of the stomach. So
yes. If
you remove pretty much all the stomach, then you would just really make the cut in the abdomen, and then you would reconnect it essentially to the esophagus. So your esophagus and then your small intestine.
Yeah.
Each other, say hello.
And as I'm reading, and I should note that, first of all, I don't have any personal connection to anyone who's received this procedure. And I know from the research that it can be a huge adjustment to make in your life.
Years long.
Yeah, years long. And it's nothing to giggle at. It's nothing to take lightly. But that being said, the procedure itself, like in a detached way, is just very fascinating because there's something kind of almost do-it-yourself-ish about the idea of taking something as complex as the human body and saying, like, all right, part A connects to part B, connects mm-hmm. to part C, if I take part B out, can't I just connect A and C and everything will work just fine? And if you presented that to me, I would say, God, no, don't connect A and C. But,
I'm seeing this in IKEA directions.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you wouldn't do that with IKEA and expect your bookcase to hold up. But the body is, surprise, surprise, far more durable than an IKEA bookshelf.
Yeah, and if you have gastric cancer and you don't have many options in front of you, then you are going to opt for the surgery. Or if you are someone who tests positive for carrying the E-catarine gene, which is a rare gastric cancer, it's a way of heading off the disease at the pass, right? Because if you have five people in your family who have this rare type of gastric cancer, and you think that, and you've tested positive for this gene, you think you might be next, well, then you might take, as you say, things into your own hands and make this decision.
Yes. Though, get someone else to do the surgery, for sure.
Yeah, that part, yeah.
So, essentially, in the case of like a full stomach removal, you're talking about the esophagus mm-hmm. being connected directly to the small bowel.
Mm-hmm.
So, a shortcut, if you will, an entire road of the highway has been removed and then hooked up.
Right, and it has parallels to gastric bypass, right, mm-hmm. which is when you take a bit of the stomach and you tie it off and you make the stomach smaller so that the person is able or not able to digest as much food and therefore lose weight. And it's really something that's very helpful for obesity. But it's the same idea, is that you adapt to it and eventually, you know, those teaspoons of food that you have become a little bit fuller. Now, someone who has gastric bypass or a gastrectomy, they're not necessarily going to be able to eat, like, you know, a whole pizza.
Yeah, my understanding is going to be a lot more, like, smaller meals mm-hmm. consumed throughout the day. But the body is going to adapt and be able to absorb nutrients pretty steadily. The only standout here is when it comes to B12.
Right.
The stomach controls the absorption of vitamin B12, so regular injections of that particular vitamin are going to be necessary.
And then there's the question, too, I suppose, longer down the road, is what does your microbe colony look like?
Yes.
With the absence of the stomach doing the sorting, how much of that matters before it actually gets to the true digestive process in the small intestines and the large intestine?
Now, of course, your diet's going to change also in other ways. For instance, you're going to eat most normal foods, but there are some things like sweet corn, for instance, that need additional softening by acids in the stomach. And, you know, as we all know, even that's not necessarily enough to get the job done. So if you have had your stomach removed, you may need to skip those particular foods. And then this was extra fascinating as well. Read that in time, pouch actually forms in the small intestines that is essentially for food storage a little longer as it continues on this journey. So.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
So it still creates a little refrigerator in there to try to store your food.
Yeah, it's almost like your body saying, oh, I see what you did there. Here, I'll put some extra room here.
I'll give you a mini fridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's a testament to the durability of the human body and its ability to cope with really catastrophic changes to its systems.
So, we were hearing about the stomach and how wondrous it is, and then you start to think about hydrochloric acid.
Yes.
And all of these wonderful ingredients that are corrosive, right? So the question, of course, that comes up and that was covered in Gulp by Mary Roach is, well, why doesn't the stomach digest itself anyway?
Yeah.
It's got all the ingredients, right?
Yes, it does. And so stomach versus stomach, what's happening? Well, as she I believe pointed out in our interview, the thing is that your stomach is digesting itself to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not like your stomach is constantly reconstituting itself. It's constantly rebuilding itself. Just like our bodies are constantly mm-hmm. wearing away and rebuilding.
That's right. Dead cells are replaced by new cells.
Yeah, yeah. Every time you go to the grocery store, as I've said before, you are buying the things you're going to build your new body out of.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the acid in the stomach is breaking down the lining, but then it is building back up. And as Mary Roach points out in her book, what happens when everything shuts down? Well, then the stomach does digest itself a bit.
Well, and that's the only time truly that the stomach would digest itself, right? So if you were eating that haggis, right?
Yes.
And the body shut itself down. And it also shut down this ability to line the cells of the stomach with mucus,
right,
which is protecting the stomach from the acid. that function stops, but the acid is still there, right? That pH level is still there. The haggis is there. It's just going to keep doing its job.
It's going to continue to eat the haggis, and it's going to continue to eat the stomach lining without it being built back up again, without any kind of renewal going on.
So that's cheery.
Yeah, but I mean, once the body shuts down, everything's going to pot anyway, so.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So what else you got? What else you got on the stomach? I mean, clearly there's a lot. We could probably go all day with various tidbits. But.
Well, you're probably wondering what foods that I eat on a regular basis turn into poop at what rate?
Yeah.
Right?
Because you want it to turn into poop. Because if you don't want to see the meal come out as it was, because that's a bad sign.
No. Yeah, that really is a bad sign.
Yeah. And it ultimately means you didn't get your money's worth out of the food either.
You should take that back to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Get a refund.
Get a refund on all undigested portions of the meal. Yeah.
All right. I cribbed this from How Digestion Works on HowStuffWorks.com. And bananas, 4 hours.
Huh.
4 hours, 4 minus T to poop time. And bowl of cereal, again, 4 hours. Hot dog, only 7 hours. Red meat, 12 hours. And trick question, gum, what do you think it is?
I heard that it lasts forever inside you in a ball of accumulating gum.
That's right. It's never.
Really?
Yeah. Well, not accumulating.
Yeah.
It just doesn't get digested. It just kind of comes out with the rest of that stuff.
See, don't swallow your gum. There's just no need. I mean, don't spit it somewhere, but.
And I was going to say, you could say that to kids as a way to deter them from it, but then they'll just be like, that's so cool. I would love to see that come out in my poop.
That's right.
Kids, they love it. They love
like
the poop.
That, yeah.
So there's a scoop on the poop.
The scoop on the poop. Yeah. Now, Mary Roach's book, Gulp, spends a lot of time with the stomach, and there are a number of tidbits. One of the ones that I keep coming back to, and I'm probably stealing from the podcast we're going to record next, but there are regurgitation artists who would swallow a live frog with a certain amount of water,
mm-hmm.
and then within the right before the act, right before they went on stage, and then when they're on stage, they make themselves throw up, and lo and behold, out comes a bunch of water and a live frog. I found that amazing because the frog breathes through its skin,
mm-hmm.
breathes through the water, so you're giving it just enough survival equipment to last a little bit inside the stomach.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Kids, don't try that at home.
Don't try that.
Adults, there's your next cocktail party trick.
Yes. You gotta start with the smallest frog, you know. That's sensible.
But not one that's brightly colored.
Yes, don't go for the brightly colored.
Not the Turrilibus. That's probably the most potently poisonous frog out there.
All right, well, on that note, let's call over the robot and get a little bit of listener mail. All right, this one comes to us from Michael. Michael writes in and says, I was just listening to the Lucid Dreaming episode, and Robert mentioned that he had dreamed up a really cool game. He's referring to the fact that I had a dream in which I was playing a card game that did not exist. And he says, I was wondering if you had ever heard of GameCrafter. It is a print-on-demand service for board games, so you could have them made up for you. Well, there you go. And then he adds, anyway, I'm a pretty new fan of the show and have been listening to the episodes this past week. I love it because it has the fun of chatting with friends in the middle of the night with the added bonus that you guys really know what you're talking about. Thanks, Michael.
He doesn't even know. That's so cool. He doesn't even know that we do this in a tent with a flashlight.
Yeah. But no, I love what he's saying there because it does, like some of the topics we cover, and, it reminds me of like being in middle school,
mm-hmm.
and younger, going to scout camp, and we're sitting there in our tents. It's night. The lights are out, and we're talking about like the cosmos. We're talking about something. Getting into that sort of middle school area of cosmology and psychology and philosophy. Ultimately, like going up to the edge of human understanding as we perceived it in those days, and trying to figure out what exists beyond us.
And then all of a sudden, you hear Borberimi.
Exactly. So cool. Thanks for sharing that, Michael. Pull out another one here from the robot's basket.
Oh, he has a basket now.
But today he has a basket.
That's very quaint.
I don't know what's going on there. If something's broken or or if he's just being stylish.
I think he wove that basket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very, very seasonal. All right, we heard from Jared. Jared writes in and says, I'm listening to your podcast on multitasking, and I always thought that drummers were multitasking as they played, playing four different beats at the same time and making them all sound good together while keeping a steady time signature and making sure you're playing along with other members in the band seems like doing multiple things at once. Would you say that it's more likely that drummers are really good at switching focus quickly and relying on muscle memory for the rest? I've also read that playing a drum set forces you to use both hemispheres of your brain at the same time. Any feedback you have would be greatly appreciated. I've always been extremely curious about what happens in the brain during this particular task, because not only is it a lot of fun, great cardio, and a great attractor of the female persuasion, but it really has been therapeutic throughout some of the more stressful times in my life. Thanks, Jared. Well, that's an interesting thought about drummers as multitaskers. I'm sure we have some other drummers out there listening, so I would love to hear their feedback on it. Because yeah, there's a lot going on, especially when you look at the big like crazy drum sets where there's just there's like a gong and there all sorts of stuff going on there.
Now, my brother's in a band, and he claims that all drummers are eccentrics and extroverts.
Huh.
Now, this is totally unscientific.
That's why they stick them in the back.
Yes, right. And anecdotal. Well, yeah, but there's a lot of flair going on with the sticks.
There is. There's a lot of, a lot of movement, a lot of just, waving your hands about. And you do think about some of the more famous drummers, and they do kind of seem like wild men.
Larger than life.
Like Mick Fleetwood comes to mind as,
Tommy Lee.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know why I had to say his name like that. So anyway, if any drummers out there, please let us know if that is true or not, although it still remains anecdotal, unscientific.
Well, here's another one. This one comes to us from Eric, and he is responding to our episode on objects and our love of objects and Lucky Charms and whatnot. And he says, I love the Lucky Charms podcast. When I was in high school, a basketball player got into his head that his socks were lucky. He refused to wash them, and by the end of the season, they were very rancid. With his help, the team made the state championships. I don't know if it was in a playoff game or the last game of the season, but near the end, he developed a blister due to his dirty socks. The blister festered, and he developed blood poisoning. He spent the championship game in the hospital near death and with the doctors arguing whether to amputate or not. He did keep his leg and made a full recovery, fortunately, but he missed the big game. After that, the coach forced all the boys to wash their socks.
Wow, that is a dark turn for the lucky socks there.
I wonder if they were destroyed, if they were put away in that same storage facility where they put the Ark of the Covenant. Like it's a potent lucky charm, but it's too dangerous for human use.
Right, and if it were to be excavated and the container opened, then all high school basketball teams would suddenly fail.
Yeah,
the reek of the sock would emanate.
All right. Well, if the rest of you have something you would like to add about rancid socks, about Lucky Charms, about drummers who are multitasking, or more to the point of this podcast, about the stomach, about the esophagus, do you have any crazy tales of Burberigibi?
Borborigibi.
Borborigibi. If you have stories of this and times when your stomach has been talking to you when you would rather it remain silent, we would love to hear about it. And certainly if anyone has experience with gastric bypass or any type of stomach surgery and would like to share that, either accredited or anonymously, or if you just want to share it with us and just, tell us, don't read it on the air or whatever, we'd love to hear your perspective on all of this because, like I said, it's fascinating for us, but it's always interesting to hear what you guys and gals have to share about your personal experiences with the things we talk about. So, you want to get in touch with us? Well, there are many ways to do it. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Tumblr. We are Stuff to Blow Your Mind on both of those. We have a Twitter account, Blow the Mind. And also, you can find us at our very own website, www.stufftoblowyourmind.com.
That's right, where we are also putting out some videos on some related topics, so check that out. And you can always send us a line at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.